It is Monday, July the 24th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, Turkey's treading lightly in the Qatar Reef.
Turkey, like the United States, does not want to needlessly offend any of the states involved in this dispute.
Also ahead, uptick in Israeli-Palestinian tensions.
The worst-case scenario is that we could be heading toward a third Palestinian intifada, and that's something that disturbs a lot of people on various sides.
The Russian investigation plus some wild music from some sisters. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Turkey's president has waded into the diplomatic crisis gripping Qatar and four other Arab nations. Recep Tayyip Erdogan is on a three-country Gulf tour aimed at helping break the impasse. Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, and Bahrain cut ties and transport links with Qatar in early June, accusing it of supporting extremists. Qatar strongly denies the allegation and sees the dispute as politically motivated. Erdogan joins top diplomats from Britain, France, Germany, and the United States who are attempting to help ease the tensions, which are being mediated by Kuwait. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Middle East Institute scholar and former U.S. ambassador to the United Arab Emirates, David Mack, what Turkey's stake is in all of this.
Turkey shares the stake that the states of the region have, as well as the United States and other NATO governments. We share a stake in fighting extreme Islamic terrorism. Turkey has been a direct victim of this, and for Turkey, being able to join in with others in a common front against the threat of the so-called Islamic State and Al-Qaeda and similar extremist organizations is very important. Secondly, of course, Turkey is a significant rival of Iran for strategic influence in the area, and Turkey would much rather have allies within all the GCC states rather than have the GCC states divided in its approach.
Turkey also has a base in Qatar.
That's true, but then the United States has a much larger base and much closer and more important relationships with Qatar than Turkey has. I don't think the fact that Turkey has a relatively small number of forces in Qatar, that is a particularly important issue here. Nor do I look at Turkey as being the heavyweight champion of mediators on this issue. Obviously, the United States has deferred to Kuwait as the lead mediator on this question, but Kuwait, being a relatively small state, I think appreciates having a lot of international company in trying to heal this breach between Qatar and its neighbors.
Well, Mr. Erdogan's past statements have suggested Turkey backs Qatar in this dispute. He was very delicate in his remarks in Saudi Arabia, making sure that he didn't offend the Saudis. He said Saudi Arabia has a big role to play in solving the crisis, taking care, it says, not to explicitly criticize the kingdom. Is the kingdom in need of criticism? Or what was Turkey's diplomatic delicacy all about?
Well, I think that Turkey, like the United States, does not want to needlessly offend any of the states involved in this dispute.
Again, he is the fifth world leader, top diplomat to go through this. Why is this so difficult? Qatar seems interested in engaging in dialogue, but the four countries that cut ties in early June don't appear to be interested.
Well, I think that there is a lot more interest under the surface. I think we have seen gestures by both Qatar and by the United Arab Emirates, for example, toward a certain amount of detente. The GCC states have already stepped back from this very lengthy list of demands to simply say that they wanted to see Qatar agree on five basic principles. And for the most part, those are principles that Qatar is in agreement on. But there's still, obviously, a lot of details that need to be worked out.
But are we stepping toward a solution, do you think?
I think that we are gradually moving toward a solution. It's worth putting this in perspective. These divisions of opinion between Qatar and Saudi Arabia particularly are longstanding. They go back several decades. And the differences between Qatar and some of the other states are a little more recent. In the case of Egypt, for example, the differences really relate, started up after the overthrow of the Morsi government.
David Mack is a Middle East Institute scholar, former U.S. ambassador to the United Arab Emirates. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. We should note here that Mohamed Morsi served as the fifth president of Egypt. That was from June of 2012 to July of 2013, when General Abdel Fattah el-Sisi removed him from office in a coup, and that followed massive street protest. Morsi was a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, what's key here is that the anti-Qatar quartet is insisting that the country accept a 13-point list of demands to end all of their problems. One of the points is to cut ties with the Muslim Brotherhood. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. Bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. Israel's Security Cabinet met Sunday to review a decision to install metal detectors at a contested Jerusalem holy site following a week of escalating tensions there with the Muslim world, mass prayer protest, and Israeli-Palestinian violence. In the midst of all the tensions, a number of people have been killed, including two Israeli soldiers. VOA asked Randolph-Macon College Middle East scholar Michael Fishbach for his read on what's happening.
The worst-case scenario is that we could be heading toward a third Palestinian intifada, and that's something that disturbs a lot of people on various sides because it inevitably would lead to bloodshed on both sides. There's been a lot of frustration, certainly among Palestinians in recent years, frustration at any number of sources of blame. And something like this, which deals with religion, is just as if it's a third rail. And so that, I think, is what all parties are desperate to try to avoid, is the outbreak of another riser.
We also asked Dr. Fishbach about whether the Israelis are justified in banning weapons and screening for them at the contested holy site.
Well, the Israeli government has said that it is routine for houses of worship around the world to have metal detectors. Of course, everything in the Israel-Palestinian context depends on the history. Literally, as far back as the Ottomans, there have been what are called status quo laws that have dealt with how different religious sects and different nationalities deal with, share, use certain houses of worship in what is today Israel and the West Bank and Gaza. And certainly in the case of this particular sacred area, Palestinians claim that putting any kind of bar or hindrance upon worshipers represents a change in the status quo. Israel has said, well, of course, this is a security measure following up on the attack that killed two Israeli border police. Now, of course, Palestinians and indeed many in the international community would say, well, it's like a chess game back and forth. Well, but international law allows a captive population to use armed force to in the service of liberating itself from an occupier. And I think many Americans particularly forget that East Jerusalem is occupied territory under international law. And there have been even opinion pieces I've seen on the Internet saying that the Palestinians have a right to use force. These were not attacks randomly on Jewish civilians. They were on Israeli security forces. So it's kind of a ping pong back and forth. It depends on who you talk to, whether these measures constitute a safety measure, and safety for whom? Is it to protect the worshipers themselves, or is it to protect occupation forces? So it's one of those things that it's almost irreconcilable, the viewpoints on whether this is a necessary or legal or proper procedure.
UN Security Council has scheduled an emergency meeting for later today to discuss the recent spate of violence between the Israelis and Palestinians. By the way, the most brutal fighting between the rivals in years. Washington Post newspaper reporting that Russia's ambassador to the U.S. told his supervisors in Moscow that he discussed campaign-related matters with U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions. That was last year during the presidential election season, contrary to what Sessions has said. White House spokesperson Sarah Sanders says the president is ready to move on from the Russia probe being conducted by a special counsel and several congressional panels.
The president has absolutely nothing to do with any of the allegations that are being made. I think he's maintained that, and he wants them to complete their process as quickly as possible so that we can move on from the ridiculousness of all things Russia and Russia fever.
In recent weeks, President Trump has expressed anger about the Russia probe after learning about the types of questions he and his family might be asked. The White House has indicated that President Trump will be signing a sweeping Russia sanctions measure this week, which lawmakers could take up, that requires him to get Congress's permission before lifting or easing the economic penalties against Moscow. Legislation is aimed at punishing Moscow for its military aggression in Ukraine and Syria and for meddling in last year's U.S. presidential election. The sanctions targeting Russia have drawn the most attention due to Mr. Trump's persistent push for warmer relations with President Vladimir Putin and ongoing investigations into Russia's interference in the campaign. VOA's Lori London asked former Central Intelligence Agency officer Jack Rice if there is definitive proof of Russia's meddling.
From my perspective, we have 17 intelligence organizations in the United States who are absolutely dead certain about this issue. Then let's go through the long list of connections, and the numbers just continue to expand exponentially, seemingly every week. And every time we see this, what I hear from the White House, what I hear from his people, whoever they are, how as combative as they wish to be, it doesn't change the facts and the reality on the ground. And so when the president simply says, I'm not sure, my response is, well, guess what? There's a whole lot of people, professionals who've been doing this for decades, including multiple members of the intelligence community with 6, 7 or more presidents that they've worked for. And I've worked for a Republican and a Democrat president. And from my perspective, it doesn't matter. This is a professional question. The connections were about what the Russians did. The fact that he's willing to deny this, despite all that, frankly tells me more than if he actually agreed with it.
What does it tell you?
That's scary.
What does it tell you?
What scares me about that is the president is so dogged in his denial of this that it tells me that there is far more to this story than we already know, and that the potential is that there may actually be direct connections between Trump and his people through the campaign itself that has not come out yet. Because if he were to simply agree and say absolutely, then for whatever reason, that in itself would at least tell me he's going to be open, he's going to be transparent. In fact, what he has been from the beginning is to be as obstructionist as possible.
The president, in an interview with the New York Times last week, also gave somewhat of a warning to special counsel Robert Mueller investigating this whole thing that, you know, he has a red line that don't start looking into his personal or family business dealings that don't have to do with Russia. But it seems as though Mueller is doing just that.
It's not shocking that Bob Mueller would expand his investigation in this case. If we look back at the investigation of Bill Clinton, not that it's directly similar, but it is somewhat similar. What we found is that Ken Starr started his investigation looking at Whitewater. By the time it was done, he was looking at a blue dress. You realize that what happens, like any investigation, is that once you start the investigation, you take it where it leads you. That's what a special investigator has the capability of doing. That's what he may be doing in this case.
We've also heard reports that the president is looking at ways to possibly fire Robert Mueller. What happens if he fires him? And can he fire him?
The potential is he actually may have the capability. What he would actually have to do at this point is go to the assistant director of the FBI on this case and tell him to fire him. The net result at this point is likely you would see a resignation there. Now, the potential new director actually was asked this very same question. He thought something was inappropriate. He claimed that he would also resign under the circumstances. Again, he wasn't specific about this issue because he wouldn't comment on it. But the president technically has the capability. The real question, however, is if he were to do this, we're going to have one fundamental litmus test at this point. And that litmus test would be, and I mean this for the Republicans in the room, in the House and in the Senate, and that's what's more important to them, their party or this country. It is that blatant. If he fires special counsel Robert Mueller, this is potentially devastating and a constitutional crisis for this country. And the Republican Party needs to step up as Americans instead of as Republicans.
Lawmakers have just reached a deal on Russian sanctions. But will the president sign the bill? And what does it say if he doesn't?
That's a fascinating question, considering today he had two of his senior communications people who said completely opposite things. One said he thinks it's a great idea, we should support this, and he would sign it. The other one, Scaramucci, says, I have no idea what the president's going to do. He hasn't decided yet. So in other words, we don't know. What I do know, however, is that the potential here is that there were a lot of Republicans in support of this bill, a lot of them. And so the potential here is this forces them again into the corner where they have to ask themselves, are they Republicans or are they Americans? And I think it's a real question. I truly mean this. We're getting to that place where the Republican Party is going to have to decide whether this guy is one of them. And what I mean is Republican, or maybe he's actually doing things that are only in his benefit, not in the benefit of the United States. And that is a fundamental and critical question that must be asked at a certain point. Maybe we're not there yet, but we're certainly approaching that line.
That's Jack Rice. He is a former CIA officer, and he was speaking with my colleague, Lori London. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A team of anthropologists exploring a cave system in South Africa has found the fossilized remains of a new modern human ancestor. The scientists say it's possible that the new hominin species may have even lived along with the earliest modern humans and probably other hominin species over 200,000 years ago. The newfound relative species is called Homo naledi. Anthropologist and research team leader John Hawks from the University of Wisconsin says that the discovery included the remains of three juvenile and adults and includes a complete skull. Finding the gathering of remains leads Hawks to think that the Homo naledi used large remote places to store its dead. This behavior, he says, is something that suggests great intelligence and possibly the first stirrings of culture. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. In our report from the music department, the story of a group of sisters. They won a lot of accolades, sold millions of records, all the while getting a bunch of their fans to get up on their feet and jump. Sisters are an American singing group who came on the scene in the 1970s and are still going strong more than 40 years later. It all started when June and Bonnie Pointer began singing in clubs in their hometown, Oakland, California. Not long after that, Sister Anita joined up to help propel the trio to superstardom. Pointer's music touches on all genres, from pop to disco, jazz, bebop, blues, soul, funk, dance, rock, and even country. They've won 3 Grammy Awards and received a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. The group had 13 U.S. top 20 hits between 1973 and 1985. And one of their big numbers was Neutron Dance from the film Beverly Hills Cop. I don't want to take it anymore.
Stop and get away. Cause I work so hard to make it every day. Ooh. Ooh. There's no money falling from the sky. Cause a man took my heart and robbed me blind.
I'm looking for Victor Meatless.
Someone stole my brand new Chevrolet. And the rent is due, I've got no place to stay. Ooh.
How you doing? You come in for a second, please?
June Pointer, the youngest sister, struggled with drug addiction for most of her career, leaving the group in 2004, and dying from extensive cancer in 2006 at the age of 52. She was replaced by Ruth's daughter, Issa Pointer. Since 2009, Anita, Ruth, Issa, and Ruth's granddaughter, Sadaka Pointer, make up the Pointer Sisters. They rotate the lineup, most often performing as a trio. But when it was the original three in 1980, the Pointer Sisters had a super hit, He's So Shy.
Speak, but did not dare. Something inside whispered to me, you better move.
And I tell you who's not so shy, it's Eddie Murphy. He's the star of Beverly Hills Cop. You heard him a half a dozen times or more in that Neutron dance song. Great, great actor, great song, great film. Listen, many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Latest world news is straight ahead. Hope you'll stay with us. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Greg Burns, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Monday. And now some more of the Pointer Sisters.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The liberation of Mosul is a critical milestone in the global fight against ISIS. This victory, and every significant victory of the campaign, was achieved with the support of the 73-member nation global coalition to defeat ISIS and with Iraqi security forces. But the battle in Iraq is far from over, said Special Presidential Envoy for the Global Coalition to Counter ISIS, Brett McGurk.
Iraqi forces with our support will soon move to liberate remaining territories controlled by ISIS, including Talafer, Hawija, and Al-Qaim. We will support them in the military campaign and in what comes next at the humanitarian, stabilization, and governance levels.
This plan was a success in Mosul, said Mr. McGurk. On the political level, we worked to ensure full cooperation between Iraqi security forces and the Peshmerga, a level of cooperation we later saw on the ground. On the humanitarian level, we planned with the United Nations and the government of Iraq for nearly 1 million displaced people from Mosul. Every single one of them, said Mr. McGurk, received assistance and aid. At the stabilization level, we planned to meet immediate needs, including police force, clearing landmines left by ISIS, restoring electricity, water, sewage, rubble removal, and work programs. Syria will be far more complicated because we do not have a government to work with there. Nonetheless, we will work with local populations from the areas freed of ISIS control to restore their communities and return the displaced to their homes. It'll take a global network to defeat the ISIS network over the long term, said Mr. McGurk. There is no question, however, that 3 years into this global effort, we stand united. 73 members from around the globe in common purpose, the destruction of ISIS and the protection of our own citizens and homelands through our joint cooperation.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.